So if you think about it, composition is really pretty basic in physics. You know, anytime you try to set up a physical theory, usually you try to imagine smaller things which are put together to make bigger things. So here's some examples. Make a table from legs and some surface from the top. If you have some large region of space-time, you can think of that as being comprised of many smaller regions of space-time. So you may have fields there. So then you can imagine sort of sewing those smaller regions together to make the bigger region. If you think about an experiment, well, during an experiment, you use various apparatuses. And you can imagine those apparatus uses being operations, and that you can sort of wire them together in the form of a circuit. So that's a very generic kind of physical situation. So all of these are where you're composing some bigger thing from smaller things. It's a very, very generic situation in physics. So what we're going to be interested in the first place is the description of composite objects. I've used the time-honored tradition of writing important words in red. So we're going to be interested in the description of them, independent of whether or not those objects can actually exist. So here's an example of an object that that you can describe. So you can describe each join in this. So each of these local joins is something you can describe. It's just two beams joined at right angles. So you can describe the composition of this object, and yet the total object is clearly impossible. Whilst it wasn't impossible to draw this, it was very difficult, and I'm very proud of the TIX code I have for doing that, should you ever want a copy. So here's an example of an object that can be described, but isn't actually possible. So later on, so for the first and most part of the talk, I'll be interested in description. But later on, I'll talk about prediction. So there's various things you might be interested in predicting. So for example, you might want to predict, is the object possible? You may be interested in what the probability is for the object that you build. So in the example of a circuit, on each operation of that circuit, you may have some outcomes, and you may be interested in what the probability is for various outcome assignments to the different operations. So you may be interested in the probability. Or you may be interested in some other property of the composite object, like its width. You know, if you build a table or some piece of furniture out of various bits and pieces, then that piece of furniture will have a width, which depends on how you compose the piece of furniture. So for the purpose of a prediction, we'll see that you can think in terms of each object having a generalized state. This is a more general notion than the usual notion of a state in physics. And I'm going to propose what I call the composition principle. So this principle says that we can establish the generalized state for a composite object by means of a calculation having the same structure as the description of the composition of that object. So that will be clearer, I hope, when I actually come to give you this composition principle. And what I'm hoping is that this composition principle is potentially a very powerful principle if you're trying to either understand some existing physical theory or perhaps construct new physical theories. So here's an example. We take a two-dimensional table. The reason we take a two-dimensional table is because it's a lot easier to draw a two-dimensional table. And you can think of this two-dimensional table as being composed in the way I've shown here. So here, some particular type of join here and here. This may consist of using glue. So you stick the legs onto the top. Of course, if you just use glue, probably the table will break. So a better join would be where you use some screws. perhaps in addition to glue. In any case, you can compose this table like this. And we're going to use some more abstract notation. I'm going to call this notation the tensorial notation because it's very similar to tensorial notation. But this isn't, these objects here in this tensorial notation aren't necessarily, in fact, they aren't taken to be tensors. They're objects that go into making some bigger object. And so there's two ways of writing this. We can either use this sort of abstract diagrammatic notation where we just represent every object by a circle. And then we have various points of exit from that circle indicating the sort of position on the object and various points of entry. And then we have join types. So this is diagrammatic notation. Here is symbolic notation. In the symbolic notation, we have to introduce these integers that tell us that this leg here is attached to this table at the position corresponding to the first subscript, and this one at the position corresponding to the second subscript. But these two sorts of notation are equivalent. One is diagrammatic, one is symbolic. Yep.
Is there any significance to the raised and lowered positions?
So in general, a join is going to be an asymmetric thing. When you put two objects together and join them, that in general could be asymmetric. It doesn't have to be, but in general it will be. And so we have an arrow. And I guess in my diagrams, I've chosen the arrow to go from the upper subscript to the lower subscript. So the whether it's an upper subscript corresponds to an arrow pointing out, and a lower subscript corresponds to the arrow pointing in. And it just indicates the possible asymmetry of the join. Okay. So one thing that's important is that this tensorial notation that I'm using has implicit assumptions built into it. And most of the talk is going to be about actually taking a step back to a more primitive notation and then examining the sort of axioms you might want to impose that would ultimately lead you to suggest a notation like this one.
Listen.
Yeah.
The asymmetry of the joins, should I think of that as something asymmetric in the composition of the object? Or should I think of that as maybe, you know, the way you assemble the object as an asymmetry?
I would think of it as the method of assembly. So for example, in the gluing analogy, in the gluing example, you would put the dot of glue, say, on the top of the leg, and then attach it to the tabletop. And that would be
that example, doesn't the asymmetry disappear? Like, what, you know, once
it may do, yeah.
Table,
it may do.
Now nobody can tell whether the glue was put on the table.
Absolutely. Well, it could be that the tabletop is made of metal and the legs are made of wood, and the glue simply doesn't work in the case when it's applied to the metal first. But sure, it may be for many physical objects that they're symmetric. You may want to describe it in a symmetric way. So in geometry, if you have two areas and you want to join them, you may choose to have one area sort of open at the boundary and everyone closed, so you're not replicating points. But once you've got the object that's composed, the asymmetry would disappear. Yeah.
So in fact, in the abstract index notation for tensors, you can change orientation and you get the same thing.
You can
raise and lower.
Oh, right. I mean, although you have to be, well, in that's true that you can perform an operation on each object and then change the orientation.
But you will get the same thing.
And you get the same thing, yeah. And indeed, later on, I'll talk about something like, which does something similar here. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And the main difference, if there is a difference between the tensors, the tensors are mathematical objects. These are physical objects. Okay. This is actually a table. Well, actually, it's a picture of a table, but this is meant to correspond to an actual table, whereas a tensor is an array of numbers. And I'm interested in how you put together physical objects, but yeah. Okay, yeah, so we'll talk about how to raise and lower indices later.
Are you developing a formalism for specific physical objects, like rigid objects, which preserve the identity after joining,
I'd say arbitrary objects, but maybe you could ask me that question again at the end, because there may be subtleties to what you mean. I mean, for example, you may mix together two chemicals and get an entirely new chemical, And I'm not, that's certainly not the kind of example I have at the back of my mind. And I don't think this approach would apply there. So I am thinking of objects where you join them together, but you can still point to different parts of the different components afterwards.
So in other words, you're not worried about the what happens to the glue, right?
Say
the water that evaporates.
Oh, right.
Or just to give another example, if you say, how would you describe a proton and an electron that are very far apart, and then you put them together to create a hydrogen atom?
Right. So there's a point I was going to make a few slides later, but so this idea that you've got somebody who's actually joining things together is not really the attitude I want to take. Rather, I want to think of it in the following way. You have a composite object. Okay, and now I want to analyze that composite object that's given to me into parts. So take the example of the region of space-time with fields on it. Okay, that's just something that's given to you.
So can you think about the hydrogen atom?
The trouble with the hydrogen atom is that it's not clear. It's not clear that's the kind of example I want. You don't really have operational access to the electron and the proton in the object.
Say something for microscopic.
Well, it could be microscopic, but maybe conceived differently. So for example, let's just take a situation with classical fields.
Yeah, the running I had with the table is it's also the same thing as with the hydrogen atom. So it's a running of bound states, right?
Mm-hmm.
A bound state is different from the objects by themselves.
Right. Yeah. Now that's something I will discuss.
So the table, if you just put the legs together with the table, it's different from the tables from the legs glued to the table.
Right. Yeah.
Those are different objects.
So that's true. If you just put them, you just put them in place, but you don't glue them. That would be a different kind of join. So what you're talking about is a join type B, where you just rest them against each other. So maybe to answer your original question about
your index, so that would be the AI would be different. It would be a BI.
Exactly. Yeah. So maybe that's your point. If the glue dries, then over time the object is changing, and so the type of join is changing. Perhaps that's the way to think of it.
Would be in the index.
It would be in the index A. Yeah. Okay. So there's an interesting point here: is that in this notation, the order of the symbols, the main symbols, is meant to carry it carries no significance. So you can write this down in any order. The information is contained in the way the integers tell you where the connections are. In the diagrammatic notation, you can make a similar point. You can move these circles around, and you still describe the same physical situation. Doesn't change anything. And so this looks very natural in this notation, but actually, in some physical context, it's a pretty radical idea that your mode of description should be independent of the order. And so one example would be if you want to consider some process that consists of, say, three time steps. Most naturally, you would consider that process in terms of where you'd have time step one, and time step two, then time step three, and you'd naturally think of those time steps in that order. But from this compositional point of view, you can think of those three time steps sort of each being on an equal footing, joined together in some particular way. So you have this sort of order independence. And I'll give an actual axiom for order independence later. Okay. Here's an example. I discussed this already, but you could have this operation. So sort of some apparatus, for example, this could be a laser that emits pairs of photons. This could be a lens, and this could be some kind of detector apparatus. And you can describe something which is illustrated in this diagram in the tensor notation. In this situation, we can ask, what's the probability? So we have a particular outcome specified at each operation, we can ask what's the probability for all those outcomes being seen. Okay, so there's lots of different kinds of objects you can imagine describing in a sufficiently abstract sort of compositional language. And here's a bunch of examples. So I don't want to dwell on this. Okay. So the sort of background motivation, lots of different papers have been written, specifically in the foundations of quantum theory, which have motivated this kind of way of thinking. Most especially the sort of categorical way of thinking from mathematics is very much about composition. I'm not a category theorist, so I'm not going to attempt to bring any sort of formal category theoretic ideas into this. But it's very much in that kind of spirit. I've been especially motivated by this work of Bob Kircher and Samson Abramsky. That's Samson Abramsky of the 60th birthday festschrift that I mentioned at the beginning. So one thing that you often see in the papers of Kircher and Abramsky is the use of this kind of tensor product notation. So you might think of this as a circuit diagram. You have two separate circuits sort of in parallel. And you can write this as A tensor B here, composed with C tensor D. Or you can write it as A composed with C, so this composed with that. A tensor, this thing composed with this. So there's even a name for this. That these two being equal, I forget what it's called, the fundamental, does anyone
interchange
remember?
Interchange law.
Say again?
Interchange law.
Interchange law, okay. Okay.
Functor
reality?
Bifunctor
reality. Bifunctor reality, okay. That's at least what the guys in Oxford call it. So rather than writing this, I choose to write this. And this sort of signals a change in attitude. Now, I think that this is a much better kind of notation. So here, you've got this tremendous freedom as to how you put how you choose to tensor things and then compose things, and actually you can write the same object down in many different ways, depending on how you do that. Whereas here, really the freedom is just the order of the symbols, which is a very obvious freedom, but that's it. So this I think is a much more faithful representation of that, and it's much better to use this as a kind of notation as a springboard to a sort of general theory of composition.
I think there's a typo in that equation. You meant to put the B little b2 index on the capital B and the little a1 index.
I did. Yeah. That slightly sort of diminishes my points, but yeah, you're right. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. And the other thing I don't like about this notation is that it sort of puts the tensor product and this composition on a very different footing. And we'll see, really they should be on the same footing, I think. And I'm going to replace the idea of the tensor product by the idea of a null join. So I'll talk about that later. It's really treated as another kind of join, except one that has special properties. Okay, so now we're going to take a step back. And forget you ever saw the tensor notation. Okay, we're going to try to be more primitive. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce some axioms. These axioms are really just my attempt to get a feel for what would be good properties for a theory of composition to have. They're not taken to be a complete set of axioms for such a theory, and maybe such a complete set is possible. It may even be that I'm lucky, and actually it turns out these are a complete set, but I doubt that. So the first axiom would be the composition axiom. This, in some sense, is the most fundamental, the most primitive axiom. And that will lead to a more primitive notation called the bipartite notation. Then I have an order independence axiom. Then I have some axioms concerning null joins. And then I'm going to go back to that tensorial notation I discussed, and we'll see that tensorial notation is a way to realize the sort of properties I want from these axioms. I'll also talk about what I call R enablement. That's the possibility of raising and lowering subscripts, keeping the same object. And there's another axiom which I may not get to, which I call the boundary axiom. Okay, so here's the composition axiom. Any object composed of two objects is fully specified if we're provided with a full specification of each of the component objects and a description of the way in which they're joined. This might be taken to be a sort of a statement of the idea of reductionism, that if you can reduce a bigger object to description of its smaller parts plus saying how those parts are put together. So now we can introduce this bipartite notation I just discussed about. So if we join B to A by means of a certain join type alpha, I'll explain in a moment why I've gone over to alpha rather than A for to indicate this join. Then according to this axiom, we fully specify the composite object by this. Okay. This is the bipartite notation. So the join, this alpha, denotes both the type of join and the position of the join at each object. So the type of join is, you know, for example, putting a spot of glue on, whereas the position of the join is, you know, where you attach the leg to the top of the table. And so the join types are denoted by the sans serif letters, and the join positions are denoted by symbols like this. So alpha in the bipartite notation is given by these three pieces of information. So here's an example. If you take a metal die, M, and you join it at the 6th side to a wooden die, at the 5th side on the wooden die, and the type of join consists of putting a dot of glue on the first surface and then pressing it into place on the second surface, then you can write this like this, where gamma is G, standing for the dot of glue, 6, because on the first, in the first object, which is the metal die, you join at size 6, and then the second object, 5, because you join at size 5. So one thing I should say is, although I've partitioned this join into two kinds of information, the join type and the position, this is really just a convenience. It could be that you simply have a different join type for every possible pair of positions on your objects. So I'm not really introducing any assumptions in adopting this partitioning. It's just a sort of convenience. And as I said before, joins are really just a way of, or can just be a way of analyzing an object into parts. It doesn't have to be that you've had some object presented to you that's been made by somebody. It could just be, you know, a region of space-time divided into, which you think of as being divided into smaller regions of space-time. So nobody physically put those different regions of space-time together. You're just taking some bigger object and analyzing it into parts in a way of your choosing. So the joins are in general asymmetric, as we discussed. We put the glue on the first object and then press it into place on the second. But we can define a join, which is the same join, just described in the opposite direction. And we can describe it through this note, through this, we can define it through this equation. So if alpha is given by this, then alpha r is given by, well, you have to reverse the positions of the two objects. And you have to have the same, the join described in the reverse direction. So here, AR is the same join type as A, but just described in the reverse direction. So we put the glue on the second object, then place it into, then press it into place on the first. Okay. Is that clear? Maybe tediously clear? That's what I'm aiming for. Okay. So what about if you have more than two components described in this bipartite notation? Well, here's some examples. You can first of all think of joining A and B together, then C, and so on. Get more and more complicated examples. And you get quite complicated bracketing structure indicating a particular order of composition or a particular way of describing the order in which you compose things. But if you're just given a composite object, why should it care about the particular order you choose to analyze it into parts? Why should it care about that? So a good axiom, it seems, and this, I say, is the second most fundamental axiom, is this one, order independence axiom. So if we have a composite object with three components, then we can regard it as being composed in any order. So in particular, if we have the object D, which is described like this, then there exist joins gamma, delta, mu, and nu, such that you can describe the same object in a different order. So here, we've joined A and B, and then later appended C. And here, we join A and C, and then subsequently append B.
Lucian, what about if you literally, if A and C aren't connected without B?
So that's the example of a null join, which I'll come to next. And I want to treat null joins on the same footing as active joins. Is there another question? No. Yeah. I'll come to that. Yeah, just a moment. So I want to claim that there are potentially far-reaching consequences for thinking in this way, because if you really take order independence seriously, especially in the space-time kind of context, then you don't want to think in terms of time sequences. So in particular, you wouldn't think in terms of a state evolving in time, but rather you would think in a more space-time way about how to join together regions of space-time. So you wouldn't have to consider the different components in the sort of sequence that's suggested naturally, but you could think of them in any sequence, or in any order, let's say. Okay, so null joins. So you may have two objects, and you just want to consider them both to be part of the picture without specifying any particular join between them. So you go to IKEA, you buy your piece of furniture, and then you take it out of the box and you put it separately in different places, and then you think about what to do next. Well, at that stage, you could say, well, the different objects are joined by the null join. In actual fact, of course, the objects do have physical locations with respect to one another, but though you're not interested in those physical locations. So as far as you're concerned, these objects are not connected in any relevant way. So we call this the null join. I tried to represent that here. These two objects part of the same picture, but they don't have any particular join between them. If we have two objects that are joined by the null join, then we say they're disjoint. It's reasonable to assume that the null join, this particular way of joining objects, will have special properties. But beyond having those special properties, it should be treated on the same footing as other types of join. In fact, any particular kind of join would be expected to have special properties. So the null join is treated on the same footing. Okay, so here are a collection of properties, null join axioms. So first of all, universality. Any pair of objects, A and B, can be joined by a null join. Otherwise, you couldn't consider the two objects to be part of the same picture. Uniqueness. If a particular object, A, B, they're joined in a particular way, and that is equal to this object where they're joined by the null join, then actually that join is the null join. Okay. Symmetry. The null join is the same described in both directions. And then the last property, I call it refinement. So if an object is joined to a composite object, so you've got three objects here, by the null join, there are at least three objects, then it's appended to each component of the composite object by the null join. So if you have an object like this one here, so here you have an object A and B joined by some particular join alpha, and then C is appended to that by the null join. Well, then you'd think that C was appended to both A and also to B by the null join. And so if you write down, as you can using the order independence axiom, if you write this down in a different order, this like this or this, like this, you write this down in a different order, like here, then here you have C appended to A by a join of type beta. We know this is possible by the order independence axiom. And then the refinement axiom tells you that beta should actually be the null join. Okay. Any questions there?
So the null join, if I decompose it into join type and locations, it's sort of special in the sense that there are no locations associated with the null join.
Exactly, yeah. And you can sort of prove that as well from these axioms. Okay, so now we're going to start to take baby steps back to the tensorial notation. What I can't do for you is prove that the tensorial notation is the only way of realizing the axioms that I've given you already, but it is one particular way of realizing those axioms. So let's take some baby steps back. So we start with this bipartite notation, and I'm just going to write that down. This is just a definition. Like this. So at least in this bipartite case, I've reestablished the tensorial notation. Okay, what about, and here I'm just motivating the next axiom. What about something more complicated like this? Here's a composite object. Well, this sort of diagram is suggestive, but it looks like if you expand it, then you can think, well, you've got A and B joined together by some particular join type. And then C is joined to the composite objects A and B by a join type which is sort of composite, it's sort of CB. So, so you can see, you can think of it being joined by this sort of join type. And these are some positions. That's just that picture is suggestive. So before I go on, I just want to simplify the notation a bit. It's going to be a drag to have to carry this position index around everywhere we go. So I'm just going to drop it and assume that the position is absorbed into the notation that we have already. So rather than writing this, I'm going to assume that the xq here is absorbed into this. If you ever want to make it explicit again, then we can do that. But for the moment, let's just absorb it in there. OK. So now here is the composition locality axiom. And really, this is just a statement that you can use the tensorial notation. So if we have a multipartite composite object like this, we can represent a multipartite composite object like this if it's got three components, like this if it's got four components, and so on. Okay. And also, we impose that the particular order of the symbols doesn't matter, and even also that the particular choice of integer labels is unimportant as well. Remember, those labels just the purpose of those integer labels is just to tell you where the joins go. But they don't carry any meaning themselves. So so these objects are all the same object. Okay. The ability to change the integers is sort of a discrete version of diffeomorphism invariance. you know, the label for the points, the label for the joins. What label you give to the different joins is unimportant.
So this composition locality, we thought of as saying that there's no kind of intrinsically three-way join. You know, every multipartite join is a set of bipartite joins.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll just a slide. In two slides, we'll talk about this. Yeah. So, of course. So now with this kind of notation, we exactly capture what we have here in this illustration, and we can write it down in sort of diagrammatic notation like so. Okay. So yeah. Here's an example. The example with four. So yeah. So it could be the case that some kinds of join can only be regarded as being between more than two objects, like you're suggesting. It could be the case that when you join two objects, B and C, some new kinds of join become available that weren't previously available. And when you join C, you're appending to that new kind of join. It could matter what order you understand the composition to be taken in. So all of these things, we're assuming, are not true if we assume composition locality. So R enablement. So one, this is one more thing I want to assume. Well, actually, there's a few more things I want to assume. So by definition, this is true. This works by definition for a bipartite object. But if you have more than two objects, then this is not so obvious. And so I just assume R enablement, that it's possible to reverse to raise and lower corresponding indices by appending an R for any pair of corresponding indices. So in this case, we have the A1, and I've raised and lowered them here and put the R symbol in.
So this whole description of this composition, this is distinct from the state which this composite object could have.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. This here we're just describing the object. We're describing the way in which the object is composed, if you like. Yeah, later on, we'll talk about assigning generalized states to objects. Yeah. So this is a distinct thing, yeah. These, if you like, are just pointing to the things in the real world. Like if you say, I take a tabletop and two table legs, you're not specifying the state of those things. You're just giving them names. And then the composition tells you how you join them. So, in diagrammatic notation, obviously, if you put a superscript R on a symbol, then you just reverse the direction of the arrow. So these are two objects of the same. Okay, so what about null joins in this tensorial notation? Well, let's imagine we have two objects. We have this object and this composite object that are joined by the null join. This is just an example. Then, according to the composition locality assumption, we can write it like this. I've introduced some names for symbols. And then, using R enablement, we can raise and lower subscripts to get to this. And now we can repackage this as in the bipartite notation. Like so, and now we can just reverse the order of these two symbols using the symmetry. And we'll put an R here. Okay, and now we have the refinement axiom for null joins, which says, let's see, A should be joined to both B and C by the null join. So here, A is joined to C, so beta has to be the null join. Sorry, I got the wrong way around. B. I'm gonna look at my computer screen to save my neck. Yeah, I think I actually packaged this in slightly the wrong order. I think there's a, now we look at this. Okay, well, the point is, you want to use the node joins refinement axiom to get the appropriate thing out by itself, and then you can say, you can actually say what these joins are equal to. So what you get is that this thing, where this is the node join, is just equal to this, where we have various join types here. Okay. And my claim is that that is a consequence of the refinement axiom. And so if that's true, if whenever you have something like this, where you have pairs of objects with no explicit join between them other than the null join, well, then you can just drop the null joins and denote it like this. Since you can certainly go from this back to this just by inserting null joins. Okay. And here's another example. Go from this to this by the refinement axiom. And then there's no point in actually notating all these null joins, so we can just drop them from our notation. But they're sort of there implicitly. And now we can represent this diagrammatically by this. And so the null joins would be the extra joins that could be in this diagram. But we can just drop them because they're always there. And so now we see that when we have two disjoint parts of a composite object in the diagrammatic notation, they correspond to two disjoint parts of the graph.
If you had A arrow B arrow C, A and C would be null joined, even though they would not be disconnected in the graph.
Say that again, sorry.
If you just had A arrow B arrow C.
Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah, so you could choose to put a null join in there or not.
So null joins don't always correspond to disconnectedness.
Right, that's true, yeah. It's not both directions, yeah. So if you have disconnectedness, then you have null joins, but, yeah. Right. Absolutely. Okay. So one thing you can do is if you have some set of joins, all the different types of joins you might use, it might be that some joins are actually implied by other joins. So here's an example. Imagine I have a grid, a square grid, and I can place little rectangles made of aluminium onto the grid. Okay, so I may have two rectangles. There's two of these aluminium rectangles, or the rectangle squares. Two of these aluminium squares that are displaced by one unit of distance, and I could say that's a particular kind of join, like so. One unit of distance. On the other hand, if I now introduce a third object in the middle of these two, and I say this one is directly joined to this one, and this one is directly joined to this one, then the join of this one and this one by displaced by one unit of distance is sort of implied by the two other joins. So you kind of have redundant information. If you specify all three joins, so you have a graph like this, if you specify all three joins, then you have this information is essentially redundant. There's kind of a problem, though, because if I only have two objects, these two aluminium squares, then I need this one. So you can solve that by enriching your set of objects to include also blank squares. And so now this can be a blank square. So now if you have the rectangle, the square of aluminium attached to a blank square, which is attached to another square of aluminium, then you don't need to specify this. And so what you can imagine is having a sufficient set of join types for some given set of objects. And they're such that if you specify all those join types where they exist, then you fully specify the object. Okay. And that's a potentially useful idea because you can then reduce the number of join types you have to give. Okay, I think I'm going to skip past this boundaries stuff. This is the idea that you can sort of think of joins as corresponding to being on the boundary of an object. And then there's only so much room on the boundary to admit joins. Okay. So now I want to go from description to prediction. So like I said before, there are various different types of things you might predict, like whether an object is possible or not, such as in the case of the Penrose objects. You might be interested in the probability of the object associated with the object, such as in the example of the circuits. You may be interested in the width or some sort of minimum distance. There's various different properties you might be interested in predicting. So typically in physics, we're only interested in some subset of physical properties. And so what we do is we define this notion, the generalized state. The generalized state is a mathematical object, A, associated with an object, A. So notice the difference in font. This is just the normal maths font, whereas this is sans serif. And this object can be used to calculate the value of those properties that we're interested in for this object. Okay. So this will be clearer in the context of some examples. So typically, a state in physics corresponds to a given time, given moment of time. But this is a much more general notion of state. So you may have a state corresponding to, for example, a space-time region. You may have a state corresponding to part of a piece of furniture. Depends on what you're interested in predicting. Okay, so I'm going to give some examples. And now we come to the composition principle. So how do we calculate the generalized state for a composite object? And we assume this principle, that the generalized state for a composite object can be calculated from the generalized states for the components by means of a calculation having the same structure as the description of the composition of that object. So here's an example. Imagine we have a composite object like this. Well, the claim is that the generalized state of that composite object is given by a calculation like this, where each of these individual elements going into the calculation is the generalized state associated with the different components of that object. And furthermore, the superscript placement corresponds to some kind of mathematical operations that respect the compositional structure. So in particular, it mustn't depend, you mustn't matter what order you do the calculation in. Okay. So there's the idea.
Are you required to do the same calculation when you have the same index type?
See, mid over here.
So if I have two A indices glued together and later on also.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah, exactly.
You must do the same
then you must do the same calculation. That corresponds to the same calculation, yeah.
So not just the structure, but actually the same operation.
The same calculation, of course, on different objects because you have different generalized states in there, yeah. Okay. So here are my ambitions for the composition principle. So basically, I want this to take over all physics, but let me detail that in steps. So ambition one, none of these, incidentally, these are just really conjectures, there's a different name for this. So all physics is consistent with the composition principle. I don't know that that's true. It's a conjecture that it is true. Secondly, well, just because you can take some physical theory and make it consistent with this principle doesn't mean that a particular formulation of that physical theory is consistent. And indeed, most formulations of physical theories, from my point of view, are not consistent with the sort of obvious compositionality, the obvious way of thinking of the composition principle. However, my second ambition is that all physics ought to be formulated in such a way that it's clear that the composition principle holds. So this is a moral principle. The third ambition is that the composition principle will be a powerful tool in formulating new physical theories, such as a theory of quantum gravity. And I might add to that, and also a powerful tool in understanding existing physical theories, such as quantum theory. So in spite of these ambitions, I've actually only got two examples to give you, so the rest of physics. And the second one is really a very toy example. So really, you know, there's a long way to go before all the physics is conquered. So here's the first example. If we take a circuit, and this is in the context of a probabilistic framework, so we're interested in calculating probabilities for having outcomes, of having, you know, so we're interested in the probability of seeing a certain outcome here, a certain outcome here, and a certain outcome here. If we have the property of tomographic locality, those of you who've studied sort of reconstructions of quantum theory will know what that is. Then you can show that the probability associated with any circuit is just given by a tensorial calculation having exactly the same structure. So in this case, these objects actually are tensors, and the manipulations that you do are the usual tensorial manipulations. So if you have a repeated index, then you sum as per usual. In the case of quantum theory, you can replace these tensors by operator tensors. So the probability of a general circuit can be given by an expression like this. These are all operators in an appropriate space. And the notation, and when you have a repeated label, so here, for example, then that indicates taking the partial trace over the appropriate part of the operator space. So I can point you to papers on this if you're interested. Okay, that's the first example. Here's the second example. So imagine we have labeled tiles. So they're labeled by some integer, 1, 2, 3, etc. So we can let the nth such tile be denoted by this notation. And a complete set of join types consists of either joining the second to the left of the first tile, joining the one with a raised subscript to the left of the one with the lowered subscript. So this is one join type. I call that X. Another join type is where you place the one with the raised subscript below the one with the lowered subscript, so like this. And then the third of the three join types is the null join, where we just consider the two tiles to be part of the same picture without specifying their relationship any further. Okay. So like that. And we can build up highly composite objects in this notation. So here's a highly composite object consisting of two disjoint parts, which we can notate symbolically like this. Okay. So now the generalized state. So the physical property I'm going to be interested in are the sort of basic geometric properties. So the sort of distances, geometric relations between these tiles. So for that purpose, the generalized state can be specified by this set. So if we have, this is the case where we have an object with having no disjoint parts. Then for every pair of tiles in the object, we want to give the x displacement and the y displacement between those two tiles. Okay. So that's this is my generalized state. Okay. We can obtain a generalized state for objects that have disjoint parts. So if we have an object AB consisting of two disjoint parts, then we can obtain it just by taking the union of these generalized states. Okay. So we define, for the null join, we define it like this. Remember, we're suppressing the actual null join from the notation, but we could just as well write it in. Okay, so if we did that for the object on the previous slide, for this object, okay, if we calculate the generalized state for this object, what we'd get is all the displacements in this object and all the displacements in this object, but we wouldn't be given any displacements between the two objects because that's not specified. Is that clear? So our generalized state is the set of all displacements that can be given. And you can't give displacements between two objects that are disjoint. Okay. Now, what about if you want to join some two objects by a particular type of join, so an X join? So now, what this notation means is that I'm actually reintroducing the position into here. So we join A at tile U to B at tile V by an X-type join. That's what this means. So this is a description of the object. And now the associated generalized state is going to be given by this. This is the union of all the displacements in the first object and all the displacements in the second object and all the new displacements that brought into being by joining these two objects together at a certain location. It's given by this set here. So when you join two objects together, you induce new displacements between the tiles in the two separate objects. So yeah, so this is the this is what happens to these mathematical objects when you have an X-type join. And for any X-type join, it's the same mathematical operation. It's this one. And likewise, if you have a Y-type join, you do something similar. The only difference is in this displacement here, the little vector here that indicates that the two tiles are in the X direction or the Y direction. So if you have a single tile, then the generalized state associated with a single tile is just this. It's just n, and a zero displacement vector between that tile and itself. And now if you take that and build up a composite object using the rules that I've given you, then you can get the generalized state for a general composite object. And furthermore, you get the same answer no matter what order you do the calculation in. So any geometric properties then of this composite object is given by some functions of the resulting generalized state. So what's interesting about this example is it's not a tensor calculation. It's a sort of the calculations involve operations on sets. But it still has, you still have the composition principle satisfied. So it seems that the same principle can apply to very different mathematics. Okay. Here are the conclusions. I think my main hope for this is that it's going to be a way to construct new physical theories. So in particular, quantum gravity. You know, in quantum gravity, you don't necessarily have available to you the usual tools for composing objects. If you have indefinite causal structure, it's difficult to talk about the time evolution of a state. But if you have new tools for thinking about composition, then you might be in a better position to come up with a new physical theory. So I've gone slightly over. I'll leave it there. Thanks.